Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is a young blackjack player with an interesting story. Name of Yoshi. Yoshi lives in the Midwest. Yoshi, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thanks for having me. It's a really good honor to be on the show. I've listened to every episode.
I'm glad that you're glad. So now you live in the Midwest. Is that a good place for a blackjack counter to live?
I think it is. There's a lot more casinos than most people realize. And I'm about 4 hours from five or six big markets with big casinos. And so it gives me a lot of flexibility to go to different markets. And that was good when I was starting out. I had a lot of options and I could spread my play around.
So let's talk about starting out, right? So how did you get interested in playing and how did you start?
So I'd never even stepped foot into a casino until October 2015, a few months after I graduated college. And some college friends planned a Vegas trip, and I was out of college and I wasn't seeing them. So I was like, oh, I'll definitely go just to be with them. I don't really care if it's Vegas or wherever. And they dragged me to the blackjack table, and I liked the game. I'm pretty sure I was playing a CSM at the time, probably, because in Vegas, if you want to play $5, that's all they have. But I just liked the game, and then I kind of got hooked on it, and I started doing negative progression, and I thought that worked, and I believed in it.
It does most of the time, except when you lose.
Yeah, so I had a big losing night eventually, and I didn't want to stop playing, and I liked being in casinos, so I thought I need to learn to count cards, and then I can keep playing, and hopefully I can make money too. So
now, how did you know about card counting? Like from the movie 21, or had somebody told you about it?
Yeah, the movie 21 was the first thing, the first way I heard about it. And while I was doing negative progression, I had actually read Ian Anderson's book, Burning the Tables in Las Vegas, which is a book about card counting. And when I read it, I wasn't starting to count. I thought it was interesting, so always in the back of my mind, I knew about it after I read that book.
And
now, go ahead.
So how did you then, you decided you wanted to learn how to count cards, so what did you do?
I read Wong's book, Professional Blackjack, and I reread Ian Anderson's book, and I just looked, there's a few websites online that I took little bits and pieces from, and I kind of just went from there and really got the experience red chipping.
And how long ago was that?
The first time I counted was last July, so about 13, 14 months ago, just over a year.
And which count did you decide to go with?
The high-low.
Right. Okay. So, for our listeners, this is all leading to something. So why don't you tell our listeners what your initial bankroll was?
So I lost all the cash I had playing negative progression, and I gave rides to the airport for a few months to college students, and they all paid me in cash, and I did that pretty rigorously and built up $3,000 in a couple months, and that was my starting bankroll last July.
And you're at what now?
Over 300,000.
Pretty amazing so in story.
In 13 months, how many losing months have you had?
I have not had a losing month. And last month in August, I dropped 48,000 in one night at the Horseshoe Hammond. And then I turn out to have a $32,000 winning month, even despite that session. So I've had some really good variance, and I don't take it for granted.
Yeah, I just want to point out to our listeners that this is not the normal progression for someone who starts counting cards. So yeah, why don't you walk us through how how you progressed.
Well, I have put in a lot of hours. I've put in over 1,000 hours since I started in the last year. I really grinded red chipping it, but at the same time, I was playing with a much higher risk than I should have been. And that actually worked out in my favor because I grew my bankroll a lot quicker than I would have otherwise. And I actually made my first 100,000 without the use of software. So all the way to that point, playing with a much higher risk than I should have been and a good chance of tapping out, but I got lucky and did not. So after I made that 100,000, which was this last March or this 6 months ago or whatever, I got software. I got CVCX from Norm Wattenberger's suite and figured out that I was playing with way too high of a risk. And if I wanted to protect this 100,000, I need to bet accordingly and know exactly what my edge is on different games and whatnot. And so that's when I got really serious. But I'll always be proud of the fact that I actually took 100,000 from the casinos without the use of software or anything like that. And I think that's somewhat of a miracle.
Agreed.
Yeah, when you're doing it with red chips, you know, if you're betting big enough and have one lucky day, yeah, I think you could do it. But betting red chips and getting up to 100,000, that's really good. Now, do you provide your name to the casinos when you play, or primarily do you play as a refusal?
Up until about December or January, so my first 5 or 6 months of counting, I was all about comps and I wasn't in any databases. And so I was using a card pretty much everywhere, and that accumulated a lot of hotels, which helped me out, meals. But since then, I've pretty much been a refusal. I think my hourly wage is worth enough that the comps aren't worth it when using my name could result in more backoffs than I would have otherwise.
You, on that subject, you mentioned fairly recently you had a really bad result at Harrah's or Horseshoe Hammond, which is part of the Harrah Caesars family, and you lost 48,000, which would have required, among other things, a CTR, which you have to show ID for that, as far as I know. And they're part of the Harrah system, so if they wanted to, they could broadcast that over everywhere. This is this guy's name and picture and stuff like that. That sounds like a pretty big risk for somebody who plays uncarded. So why did you do that?
Well, first of all, I was already in the Harrah system. I've been trespassed from various Vegas Caesars properties. In Vegas, at least, they seem to go straight to trespass. And even if you don't provide a card, they're pretty good at just finding out who you are via facial recognition or flyers or whatever. So I knew that Horseshoe Hammond wasn't like those properties in Vegas. They're a lot more tolerant. They do really well in the Chicago market. They're crushing it in revenue. So they seem to be tolerant. And I wasn't really worried about them knowing my name. And especially since I'm losing that much CTRing, I don't think they're going to do too much to me. So if I have to, I'll give up identification, obviously. And that was the only place I wanted to play in the area at that point, so I didn't want to wait till the next day to buy in more. I wanted to try to play more that night since it was relatively early in the evening that I went over the CTR point.
In some places, it's getting almost impossible to play as a refusal. You know, like on the East Coast. I mean, some places are just really, really tough to play for any sizable stakes as a refusal. Are you finding that in the Midwest, or is the Midwest still respecting people's privacy?
I think the Midwest respects people's privacy more than other places. Like in Vegas, they're always pestering you for a card. And in Vegas, a lot of people are tourists, and they're just dropping through, so they're not going to necessarily get a card. Whereas in the Midwest, you have a lot more locals, yet you still get pestered less for a card. I think it's pretty chill in the Midwest, and I like that a lot.
Yeah, I mean, there are places in Atlantic City where they you're restricted as to how much you can bet if you don't have a card. So, Yeah, it's becoming a real problem in some places.
Yeah, I've never another thing to making that much in this amount of time, I've never even been anywhere on the East Coast, never been to Atlantic City. I've never been to California, Oregon, Washington, the South, never been to Biloxi. So I've really done all this in Missouri, Iowa, Minnesota, Illinois, Wisconsin, and then a few Vegas trips sprinkled in there. So I think I've been really lucky to do it without nationwide travel either in this amount of time.
You didn't mention you playing in Oklahoma. Oklahoma has a lot of games where you have to ante. Have you ever played there, and does the ante bother you particularly?
Yeah, I have played Oklahoma. I hadn't played there until a couple months ago, actually. But I like playing in Oklahoma because they have the ante. I think they think card counters aren't going to play their games as much, and they're not really worried about it too much. And so if I'm spreading enough to make a good wage per hour, even if I pay the ante and I lose 100 an hour on that, it's still going to be worth it if I can play more hours. And another thing is they're supposed to not even make any profit off of blackjack. It's supposed to be a player's pool. So technically they should like me paying that ante for 8 hours straight. That's a lot of money for them, even though I'm counting.
Yeah, they should like it, but that doesn't mean they always do. You know, there are just some bosses that have the idea, if it's good for you, it must be bad for us. So, and I think a lot of those places are just skimming the player pool anyway.
Yeah, I've been backed off in Oklahoma, and some places are sweaty. It just depends. But I think overall, it's a good landscape just because of those facts, which are unique to Oklahoma, and that's not the case in other states. So I think in a lot of casinos, there's more leeway.
This, I guess, would be a question for both of you. Since Oklahoma isn't supposed to be keeping any of the money, are the people in the pit as competent as they would be in casinos where they are money-making operations on the blackjack pit? Any idea?
I mean, like anywhere, occasionally you'll run into a really sharp boss. But my feeling is that as you get further away from Las Vegas, the IQ points steadily decline in the casinos. So
I agree. I think certain shift managers and certain bosses that might be there for one shift a day really know their stuff. And then there's a lot of hours in a lot of casinos that you can get away with a lot more.
I went to a casino in New Mexico when they first opened, and I was sitting on a game that was just ridiculous in how poorly it was being dealt. I couldn't believe, you know, what I was doing at the table. And finally I said to the dealer, "Where's the shift manager?" And he pointed to a girl, a cute little blonde girl who was about 22 years old, and that was down at the other end of the pit. And I said, "That's the shift boss?" And he said, "Yeah, 6 months ago she was a waitress."
You wouldn't
find that in Atlantic City or Las Vegas or, yeah.
It's crazy in Las Vegas. Every casino on all three shifts, 7 days a week, has a super sharp boss who's going to sweat any bet increase. And then you can go to Oklahoma and it's just night and day.
Yoshi, when Rich and I had lunch with you a couple days ago, and when you had lunch with us, you came with a friend our travel partner. We'll call him Joe for the lack of a better name. So somehow you hooked up with Joe, who's a fellow AP. So are there ways? How do you do this? How do you hook up with compatible, competent players?
So I didn't really know anyone. And when I started out, I was just doing this all alone. And I met a hole card player at a casino in Iowa. And I mean, he didn't really introduce me to other people, but he made me realize that there's a big community out there. And
how did you meet? How did that happen?
He had counted cards before and he saw I was counting and he just kind of watched and made a few remarks that let me know that he knew what I was doing. And then we talked in the parking lot afterwards. And he helped me just because he was the first guy I met, and he gave me confidence that there are people doing this out there and this could be something that I could be successful at. And then the first card counting contact I made was a total fluke. There's a guy who was in New Mexico and he got backed off via facial recognition under my name. They told him, "Yoshi, you're no longer allowed to play blackjack anymore." And he said, "No, my name isn't Yoshi." And they said, "Yes, it is. You need to leave." And so he looked me up on Facebook and found me and told me that story. And it was just a funny coincidence because we do look a little bit similar. And through him, I've met the guy I was at lunch with you and several other APs. And through them, I've met other APs. So it really started with him. And there's just a lot of ways that knowing these other people have helped me. And I think it just, once you meet someone, they can introduce you to more people and then it can just lead to more and more things. So I'm pretty lucky to have had that happen to me.
Have you used the message boards to meet people?
No, actually. I had a membership to BJ21, Wong's message board, and there wasn't that much activity in recent times, so I don't have a membership anymore. But what that was valuable for me for was reading all the archived posts, posts from the contributors that knew a lot. And so I learned a lot just reading through those things. But I never actually used the message boards. I've just been lucky to have met APs through the way I just described. And through them, I feel pretty confident in my network.
Yeah, I don't think you can put a price on how valuable networking is.
I agree. It's tough to pinpoint specific ways, but I know that if I didn't have any contacts at all, I wouldn't be in the position I'm in, and my earnings would have been a lot less. So I can say that for sure.
Your earnings would have been a lot less under any other scenario. You've been lucky, but that's good. I certainly include a lot of luck in my success. Now, earlier we were talking about you being a refusal, usually, and yet you are definitely look young enough that a pit boss can legitimately ask you to CID to make sure you're at least 21. They can use that as an excuse, and it's a very plausible excuse. How do you provide that information while still being a refusal?
In the Midwest, most casinos have a security checkpoint at the front, which isn't like Vegas where you can just walk in. So I go through that, and I think the pit bosses are, it's more awkward if they ask because they know that everyone went through that checkpoint. So if someone actually does ask, that tells me that a backoff is coming and I should just leave, because if I've been playing for an hour and now they're asking to verify my age, it's not to verify my age. So that just tells me that my time is up there. In Vegas, yeah, of course I get asked a lot at the table, and usually it's by the dealer, and I try to just give it to them really quick and tell them, "Oh, this is where my birthday is. Look, yeah, that's my year, and then have it give them back to me quick before the pit boss even kind of sees that I'm buying in, and so he doesn't have a chance to look at my name. I try to really rush that, and then the dealer will say, oh, I already checked it, and so the pit boss can't really ask at that point.
Yeah, what I tell my son is exactly what you said. If you've been playing for a while and then they come up and suddenly want your ID because of age, it's probably time to leave. In Vegas, you can also, at some places, you can go to the security stand when you first get in and ask them for a wristband. And once you have a wristband, it proves you're 21 and they have no reason to ask for your ID anymore. One of the problems in Vegas with showing your ID to the dealer is that in some of the places, in the newer places, the cameras are now so good they can rewind the tape, go back and zoom in on that ID, and get all your information from you just showing it to the dealer. One trick you can do in the Midwest is... You show your ID and go in, and what the Midwest casinos started doing was rewinding the tape to the time you came in the door and finding out who you are they find where you entered the boat. So what you can do is you can enter the boat, wait for 5 minutes or so, go back out and tell the security guard, I just forgot something in my car, I'll be right back. Now you go outside for a few minutes, you come back to the same security guard, and a lot of times he'll just let you on without looking at the ID again. So now if you go play and they rewind the tape, they see you coming in and they don't see the guard looking at your ID, so they don't have it. And they don't think to rewind the tape further to see if you had been in before and gone back out.
That is a great idea, and I bet at that point that would be when they would come up an hour after you've been playing and say, we need to see your ID. We saw you didn't get checked at the door. And then, again, that tells me my time is up.
Right.
You see, I think that's great information you just gave, Richard. Too bad you didn't give it to me 50 years ago. But
well, they didn't check your ID at the door 50 years ago. I mean, 50 years ago, they wouldn't dream of asking you your name. You could go cash out $50,000 at the cage, and nobody would ask you your name.
Maybe. Could be. I wasn't around then, and I never met Mr. Spilatro, who was in charge of things a little bit back then. And that's probably a good thing for me. I'm not sure. We talk a little bit about you having lunch with Richard and I, and you had a buddy along named Joe. And Joe was telling us over lunch that he had recently exchanged chips for cash from a famous player, but a player he didn't know. And so... do you ever do this, or have you ever had somebody do it for you? How much do you guys charge? What's those kind of things?
I've had other friends of mine, usually non-APs, cash chips for me. I have a college buddy in Kansas City area who's cashed chips for me a number of times and never charge anything. I gave him a bunch of chips recently, and I gave him $60 because he's helped me out so much. He's just helped me out in a lot of ways. And it's nice to have friends in different areas where casinos are that aren't really risking anything by giving their name to a cashier's cage. But they can really help me out by helping me stay under the radar. For big amounts at places that I'm really on thin ice at and really don't want to get trespassed, I think it's worth a lot just to have a buddy cash chip. So I'd be willing to pay small amounts.
Because I'm here in Vegas, I have done that occasionally, and I will charge a small amount, one or 2% or something, depending on how difficult I think it is to move the particular chip. You know, I don't want to get stuck with, you know, like 500. They, at Coast Properties, they call from the cage on a single $500 chip. You know what I mean? So, anyway, yeah, I've done it occasionally. But do you cash out after you've played?
In recent months, I've had a real problem playing in markets where I know they flyer. And if I do cash out, they'll get my name, and then I'm probably going to be toast for other properties. So I've wound up with quite a bit of chips. I would say close to a third of my bankroll is still in chips at this point, just for the sole purpose of playing more hours when I'm on trips and avoiding flyers. And on the one hand, that's bad because my cash is diminished for totally new places where I don't have any chips. But on the other hand, for those places that I keep the chips, it does give me some leeway to not CTR on buy-ins if I start out losing. So it's good and bad. And,
that can sometimes lead to some funny situations. If you start losing a lot, and, you know, I've certainly seen this where the bosses start having conversations like, you know, he just has this endless supply of $500 chips in his pocket, and I have no idea where he got them.
Exactly. Yeah, I think it's almost more sketchy to have a bunch of chips than buy in. Yet, it can also, buying in with cash, they're more likely to kind of
look harder at
you. Look harder, and when you have chips, you can kind of bet real fast and get into the table without too much time being wasted. So,
right, and also, yeah. If you get in, you know, $20,000 in chips that they don't know where they came from, it means you're losing a lot. So they don't really want to give you much of a hassle because you're stuck a lot of money.
Very true. Very true.
But eventually you have to cash it, assuming you don't lose
someday.
It all.
Someday.
As I've run out of more and more places to play, having a lot of chips for the places that I still can play, I don't need to cash them for a while since I'm gonna keep those places in my rotation. So if I have a lot of chips, well, I'll play there in a couple months again, and it's kind of like having cash. And if they do end up trespassing me or backing off, and I know I can't go back in a while, then I'm gonna cash and I'm gonna CTR. But until then, this is my situation.
Yeah, I would not. I mean, if I'm getting backed off or 86th, I'm going to head immediately for the door. You know, because the best photographs they can get of you are going to be standing at a cashier's cage. So, you know, I would just hit the door and either get friends to cash them or, you know, exchange them or somewhere down the road, cash them a few at a time.
Yeah, that's true. It depends on the area. If I don't know anyone in the area and I have yellow chips or a lot of purple, I think it's going to be too difficult to cash them later and let them have the picture that they're going to get. But I agree, it's more ideal to have someone else cash them. So in areas where I do have friends, of course, I'm just going to walk.
All right, we're talking to Yoshi about his blackjack career. We're going to do a few commercials now, and then we're going to be back asking him more questions. The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. In October, the casino-wide promotion is for people who are already getting free play. You get your normal free play Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday, and if you pick that up, you get the identical amount Friday, Saturday, or Sunday. If you pick up all 8 times, then at the end of the month, there's a day when you get to pick up a larger amount. So this is a very good deal if you are already on their mailing list and get mail. If you're not, it's not such a good deal. NVIDIAPoker.com It's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get corrections on most of the game. We're airing this show while I'm on vacation, and I do not know what the game of the week will be when the show actually airs. So instead, I've chosen to talk about one of the videopoker.com games you'll find out there that we haven't talked about too much too recently. The game I want to talk about now is Extra Action Poker. It's a game played normally, except if you choose the bonus hands, for every ace, it gives you extra hands where you only hold the ace. You may buy 4, 8, or 12 extra games for 5, 10, or 15 extra coins, respectively. The return on the bonus games is 99.3% and requires no skill. So if you find a game that you would normally play that returns less than 99.3, such as maybe a 99 even double-double bonus game, it's smart money to play it in the extra action poker mode because you're going to get an increase. On games where it's a deuces wild variant, then in those games, the special card is a deuce. And you get deuces. Our deuces give you your extra hands rather than aces. All right. We're talking to Yoshi. Do you have any interesting stories about being backed off?
It's always interesting. I mean, the funniest times, and this has happened to me, I'm playing a shoe, I'm betting big from early in the shoe, and they call a host over, and the host's like, "Oh, I love the way you play. I love the aggressive style." He saw me like double down on a 7 versus a 6. It was that high. He's like, "Oh, wait, I'll get you anything you want, and we'd love to put you up in a suite, and I'll cop it to you. Let me go get your room number for you." And then like 10 minutes later, still in the same shoe, I've maybe taken insurance twice or something, and they end up trespassing me. I'm surrounded by guards, and I'm like, "Oh, what about the suite?" And there's just so much contradiction. It's always hilarious when that happens. One time in Vegas, this is how I learned not to split tens in Vegas. I do split tens other places. It's definitely something I don't avoid doing when I think I can get away with it just fine. But in Vegas,
doubling hard 7 is going to, get their attention in Vegas as well.
Yeah, well, it got that host's attention in a good way. And then not the pit bosses, I guess. But in Vegas, I split tens once, and they actually swiped up the cards before I even got the cards that were going to be on the tens, or the dealer played out their hand. And I knew that was just totally against the rules. And I called gaming, and gaming said, that's not okay. Why don't you talk to the casino manager, see what he says. And so I was like, okay, I'll try that. Because I'd only talked to the pit boss and argued with him for a while, but he wasn't budging at all. So I did talk to the casino manager, and I think he was worried about gaming coming, and he knew that that wasn't what should have happened. So he agreed to pay me out the size of my bets on the table as if I hadn't split the 10. So if I just won the bet on the 20 and then on my other hand, which I can't complain about. I could have lost all the bets, maybe. Sometimes 10 splits end disastrously. So I could have won more with the 10 split, but I'm going to definitely take the result that I got.
Oh, EV-wise, with a guaranteed winner, it was much better the deal you got. So I'm going to take a rough assumption that this was your last hand there.
Yeah, that was. I mean, I think they just even like shuffled the shoe. Like they swiped up the cards and just fanned them out. So I wasn't even going to get any chance of playing out that shoe.
You mentioned when we had lunch with you that sometimes splitting tens, you're wondering if it's even if the strategy says yes, you're eating up cards in a good situation. and you're not really sure that's as good as people think it is. Do you want to expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, it's just something I've thought about. I haven't been able to really analyze it with software or anything, but I know that at a certain count, splitting tens against, say, 4, 5, 6, it gives you more EV, and over time you're going to make more if you do split tens at that count. But I don't think that takes into consideration that you'll have less rounds dealt, more cards get taken up out of that shoe, and if it's high enough to split tens, it's going to be like still a max bet shoe for several more rounds at the very least. So if you're getting less of those rounds, is it really even worth it? And is the EV more if you don't split tens, if you take that into consideration? I know if the cut card comes out and it's the last round, there's no question. But if it's not the last round, I think it might not be the best call. I'm just kind of wondered about it, and I'm not really sure.
Yeah, it's funny. That's the kind of theoretical question that I think people will have spent 2 weeks on one of the forums discussing, you know, which play is going to make you an extra 27 cents. But for most of the players that I know, it's just more about heat, and most players that I know just don't split tens because of the amount of heat it brings. And in some markets, even doubling ace-9 can be, ace-8.
Which is basic strategy against a 6.
Even ace-8 can be a big problem in some places. And that's basic strategy, right?
But in the Midwest, the bosses don't even know how to play ace-7. So if you think they know that you should double ace-8 on basic strategy, that's wrong.
Well, doubling ace-10 might get their attention too.
Yeah, I've done that. That's always fun. It's my favorite move.
Really?
Pretty rare to do, though.
I would think that, so I'm assuming you have split tens and gotten an ace and then doubled. It would not be your dealt the ace-10 and doubled.
Oh, no. One time I split tens 4 times and doubled twice on ace-ace. I think, it was just all that was left. And the dealer had a 6, so it was a fun hand.
Did that play get you barred? Or that plays out there enough that they may just think you're totally nuts.
Yeah, I think splitting tens in itself, enough hit bosses to know, oh, that's either an idiot or a counter move. But I think doubling ace-ace, or 10-ace, doubling down on soft 21, that's just 90% of them think you're an idiot, and they don't know that that's an index play. And so I think that almost deflects heat, if anything. So that's kind of why I like it as well. I think I've done that, and they assumed I'm a total idiot. Not in Vegas. They would know in Vegas, but I'm talking about Midwest.
And have you started to expand to more than just counting cards yet?
Yes, and I learned the same guy who was recognized as me in New Mexico, he's big into machines now. I think he likes how there's less variance with machine play, and you're not going to have as big a swings. It's less money, but it's more sure money. So he's taught me a few things, and I'm not going to mention any particular machines, but there are opportunities out there, and I was totally blind to them before I met him. And I think they help in two ways. I mean, it's a little more EV, and also if a casino is giving you heat about counting, but they see a slot ticket like on the table next to you, and they hear you talking about, oh yeah, I hit this on this machine, I think they're gonna be a little more unsure that you're an AP, because a lot of them just have no idea that slots could be beatable.
Yeah, especially if the ticket ends in something like 29 cents.
Yeah, so which it always does, because I actually do play the machines. If I just had a $100 ticket, that would be suspicious that I just put a bill in a machine and cash out. But I always have like $103.16, and so makes it more believable.
So these are slot machines with certain features that if the features are above a certain level, that makes the game playable. So that's generally what you're talking about without going into any more specifics. Is that correct?
In general, yes.
Okay. So what happens when you do go broke? So far, you've been on a ride that has been smooth sailing completely, other than the very early start. Someday you're going to go through pretty bad swings. Have you thought about what you're going to do, how low you can go before you're going to give up?
Well, I've heard this said before, probably even on the show. The ones who stay with it are the ones that got lucky in the beginning, and that's definitely the case with me. I think I had some other things that I was interested in, music, other things. And I think if I would have started out on a bad streak and played a ton of hours and not shown any profit, I would have just given up for sure. But obviously I had amazing variance, so it's the opposite of what happened. And I think since I've had this year of 3,000 to 300,000, it's always going to be in my mind what's possible. And if I give it up, it's not going to be because I go through a losing run. It's going to be because I lose interest or something else comes up. I think I believe in it enough, especially after what I've gone through, that I'm going to mentally be able to withstand any losing run.
Well, your friend that was at lunch with us mentioned that he's in the middle of a over 200-hour losing streak. So you think you'll be able to grind through a 200-hour losing streak and come out the other side and still just keep playing?
Actually, I've had a 150-hour losing streak in the last month. And
without a losing month?
No. So by losing streak, do you mean
you had a 150-hour break-even streak?
I'm a bit down from my all-time high. And if from the all-time high, it's been an 150-hour. It's been 150 hours. Is that? Do you mean that is an 150-hour losing streak?
Well, I mean, if you're, say within $10,000 of your all-time high for 150 hours, I mean, I guess technically that's a losing streak, but it's not one that is anywhere near as frustrating as if you were stuck 50,000 for 150 hours.
Exactly. So I'm almost back to the all-time high. I haven't been there for 150 hours, but it's been, yeah, you're right. It's been a break-even stretch, and that's been fine to handle, because when I got to the all-time high, I'd won, I don't know, 40,000 in like 2 days. So I was still on cloud nine even this past 150 hours.
Right. So you think you will be able to, do you think you'll be doing this 5 years from now, 10 years from now?
It's tough to say. I'm still really passionate about it, really pumped up about it. But talking to other guys, I mean, they have burnouts. Small cap, he was super successful, but he went through a burnout. It's really tough to say, but right now it's hard to imagine that happening. I'm always eager for the next trip. I have no problem motivating myself to put in the hours, but you can never really tell how you're going to feel 5 years or 10 years down the road.
Now, how is your family, taking this?
Well, that's another, fortunate aspect of my situation. I also work for my parents' business, but, working for a family business, you get a lot of flexibility. And with their business, I think I get more flexibility than other family businesses. So I just have certain things that need to be done, but not at any specific moment. They just have to all be done by a certain point in the future. And I can work whenever I'm home. And, that gives me a lot of flexibility to travel and play when I want. And
but what do they really think about you being out there gambling?
Or do they know?
Oh, they know. They don't know the specific bankroll or anything or profits, but they weren't thrilled with it at first. And my mom still is always worried, always texting me, wondering if I'm okay. But I think my dad especially realizes how competitive the casino industry is and all the billboards they have and how they're trying to lure every customer they can through their doors. And the fact that I'm barred from so many casinos and they go to great, such equally great lengths to make sure I don't go through their doors, that legitimizes it to them. And they can't really argue with the fact that it's probably a pretty successful thing.
When you lost $48,000 at Hammond, did you mention that to your parents?
No, I think they would have thought I'm just headed in a downward spiral and going to be broke in a few months if I mention that. They don't grasp variance necessarily, so I'm not going to mention something like that.
Have you had any problems with the police in terms of traveling with cash?
No, I haven't. I've had speeding tickets, but they've never searched my car or anything. I'm always on guard for it, though, and especially in Oklahoma, just has a reputation of more things like that happening, and I'm always going right at the speed limit. And as you said at lunch, that doesn't guarantee anything, but I'm careful.
Well, that takes care of one-third of the cases. So they do stop sometimes people going the speed limit, and the other two cases are people going less than the speed limit and people going over the speed limit. So those are the only three cases.
Yeah.
Do you have any sense, maybe this is a question for Richard, I'm not sure, of, now Yoshi says he has a lot of chips, so he implied he had 100,000 in chips, although he may not carry with him all the time, but presumably he'd have some with him. Would that be safer to carry around than cash? Richard, do you have any sense of that?
Yeah, I think a lot safer. I don't think police, when they see chips, they don't think, oh, I'm going to get my hands on this, you know, because a lot of times the chips might be for a casino in another state or something, you know, it's not, so I think it's much safer. I have a friend that I play with. We were going through the airport and he had a Ziploc bag full of chips and about the size of a football, and it was double bagged, and he put it through the scanner, and the guy picked it up and he goes, what's this? Are these chips? And he goes, yeah, like poker chips. And he goes, like casino chips? And he goes, yeah, like poker chips. And the guy looks and he goes, are these $500? And my friend goes, yeah, I'll sell you one for $100. And the guy just threw it at him and goes, get out of here. So, I think it's definitely way, way safer to travel with chips.
Yeah, they always set off the airport scanners, though. So, I mean, they're going to get looked at, but I think it's usually fine. So,
yeah,
and I've only
that's
really
why you
got to
put them in the bin that goes through the scanner. Because if they're inside the carry-on bag, they're every time they're going to want to look.
Yeah. And I usually carry I have a pouch with cash, my bankroll, in my backpack. And my first trip to Vegas, I put it inside a shoe that was also in my backpack. And I learned not to do that because they look at anything that you might be trying to conceal in a shoe. They look at that a lot more closely. So I learned don't do that. If you're going to probably just put it in the carry-on tray or the tray. And if you do put it in your bag, put it not surrounded by anything and just not like you're trying to hide it.
Yeah, I agree. And I've said this before, but for the last couple of years, I feel like it's much safer to fly with cash than it is to drive with it.
Well, I've done more driving than flying, but that being said, my driving's been in the Midwest, so it's not like I have a California license plate. I think the license plate, even if I'm in Oklahoma, it's going to help me as opposed to having one from a really far away state.
Agreed.
But on the chips that you have, if you were going to make a trip to Oklahoma, you would not have any Wisconsin chips on you. You would have left them at home in your safe or something. whereas, or vice versa, if you're playing in the Chicago area, you're not going to have any Oklahoma chips with you, presumably.
That's true.
Have you ever been ripped off or felt physically threatened while you've been a player?
If the 10 split in Vegas didn't end in the casino manager paying me out those winning bets, I mean, I felt totally gypped at first in that situation. I've never dealt with a team. I've been solo this whole time, so I haven't had teammate experiences or anything getting ripped off. I just find it really hard to believe that teams work without constant fear of being ripped off, because when people are playing in different places, I think it'd just be so hard to control whether someone's pocketing a few extra black chips or not. Yes, have I been ripped off? I actually had a great experience in a Missouri casino where I won a lot and ended up with a ton of black and just pushed it all forward to get orange chips. And they gave me 2,000 less than I should have had. So they gave me 4 less orange and I didn't even notice it because it was so many blacks. I just kind of went with what they gave me. And then I'm over at the cashier's cage and the pit boss comes over and says, "Oh, we owe you 2,000. Come back and get 4 orange chips." And that seems like the opposite of what would normally happen. Casinos are going to not do that, and yet they're going to make you give back the money when they overpay you. So that was a once in a blue moon kind of thing, but I'm pretty lucky about that.
Yeah, I haven't heard that story before. Although that has variations of that has happened to me, where I left a casino for whatever reason and had left credits on the machine, and they noted I had been playing and they cashed it out and held it for me. So that's a symbol. That's the same type of idea. Generally, I think most casinos are trying to do the right thing. The people in there anyway. Not all people and not all casinos, but most humans are in this kind of situation are trying to do the right thing. I'm sure Max Rubin doesn't share that point of view, but that's my opinion. All right. We've been talking to Yoshi about his blackjack experiences. We wish him the best of success in the future. After he starts playing in California and the other places, come back on and tell us about your news stories. Thank you, Yoshi. Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.